And so, yeah, so we're lucky to welcome here today, Winnie Yang, who is a, well, you're a neuroscience
Yes.
PhD student,
Yes.
but she also does work in interpretability and large language models. I'm not actually sure which topic she's going to talk about today. She's welcome to talk about either one, but I've been really interested in her. Her neuroscience work actually caught my eye. She's done a bunch of work in memory formation and neuroscience, and I thought it was quite interesting. So if she doesn't talk about it, then you can ask her about that stuff as well. And so you're from NYU, right?
Yes,
Is that right?
exactly.
So up for the day. And so grab a time to chat with her this afternoon before she takes off. I don't know how long you're here for.
I will be here the whole afternoon and
Okay, yeah,
evening,
that's
so.
great. Yeah, that's good. So welcome, Winnie. And you should go ahead and project
Good.
your
Can we maximize it?
yeah, well I'll set this
Just
up.
a
Are you projecting already?
Yes, I can project.
Let's see. Let's see. Are you okay?
Oh.
Okay, yeah, so go ahead and share your screen. And then we'll get you going. Excellent.
Okay, no presenter view.
You switch screens or something like that, or look at that.
Yeah, let me try see if I can share, but with all the screens.
Okay.
Okay, maybe.
See something back here.
You can
Oops, that's
close
not
the
what I
chat.
want. I can close this. It
I
won't
think
put Zoom.
again.
Okay. Okay, good. All right, we're all set.
So, hello again, everyone. So my name is Winnie. And luckily, I will talk about my work in neuroscience. But it's about learning and memory in the brain. I met Professor Bart Neurips, and I think it will be very, very interesting to start this conversation about how learning and memory works in the brain, and have fun discussions about connection with how that works in LLM. So I hope we will have fun today. Right, as David already introduced, I'm a currently a PhD student, fifth year, so almost graduating in neuroscience, and study learning and memory in the brain, and also started to do interpretability work in large language models recently. Okay, so this when you guys look into memories and stuff in large language models, you guys are very fortunate where you have this, even though it's a black box, but so easily accessible. Just wanted to give you some sense of what the challenges that we're facing as neuroscientists. So basically, when we wanted to record, how the neuron active when to perform certain tasks, we need to perform surgeries and insert electrode into the brain, and so that has been a big chunk of my PhD, practicing open the skulls of the animals, insert wires into their brain, trying to target those wires, very thin, they're about the size of like a single strand of hair. I wanted to put them in a very precise way, hopefully, into a brand area of interest, and in this case, hippocampus. And we wanted to record the brain activity while animals do something interesting. So we have to build up those mazes, like physically constructing them ourselves, going to workshops, designing like things. And then, building Arduino circuits, for example, this one, I designed a task where, when certain lights goes on, the animal need to learn, okay, green light associate with going to the right. And if it successfully goes to light right, it will get reward. So now he's waiting here. There's a waiting period. Now green lights goes on. He has to go to the right side. If he successfully go to the right side, he get rewarded here. And it's hard to see here, but the water will be automatically delivered, and there are doors on this maze so that we can restrict his behavior and just learn this task, just to give a taste of what the lab life like. Okay, and there's another example. This is a rat. Much bigger than the little mouse we saw from the video above. And this mouse is running on a very simple maze. It's just a linear maze, and the animals are water restricted. So they're very motivated to just run back and forth and get a reward at this water port. This is a very simple task, not like complicated, but it's get us to study some very a foundational property of the hippocampus, as I will share later. This is the wires that connect to the brains that we can collect their brain signals as when they perform tasks. And you have fun with your animals while you're not doing experiments. I built this like luxurious hotel for my animal, a lot of toys for them, enrich them while they're not doing tasks. And apparently, this enrichment really helped them to become faster at learning tasks. Okay, so that's the fun lab life.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So, what was the reward you said?
Sorry?
What was the reward?
What was the reward? Yes. So in our cases, we just give water.
Water.
The reason why is that they are water restricted before the task, so they're very thirsty, essentially. So they're motivated to get this reward.
Can
Some
smell.
can they smell? We don't add. There will be cases in some experimental setups. People add some other to different flavors or sometimes food palette as reward. But when animals chew, food palate will create electrical noises. That's interfere with electrical noise signals from the brain that we want to record. So we want to avoid that. That's why we choose water. Some nitty-gritty details. Okay. All right, so we put electrode in, and that's the brain region we want to study, the hippocampus. It's right located above your ear, center in the brain. This brain region, really, if you dissect it out, it looks like a seahorse, and hence the name, hippocampus from Greek. So the hippocampus has been heavily studied by neuroscientists, and it's a very, very interesting brain region, and that has been hypothesized and in involving in many interesting cognitive functions like planning and mental simulation, memory consolidation, memory retrieval. As well as form a representation of the space in the external world, and which lead to this theory called cognitive map theory. Okay, we will kind of I will go through some of my studies that touch upon some aspects of hippocampal function. And then I will divide like my work into two parts. One part is the presentation, representation part, so how things are represented in the brain. The other part is what I call operations, like memory retrieval, memory consolidation, planning, mental simulation. Those are operations. Okay, let's start with representation in the brain. Okay, this is the three, sorry, this is the overview. We'll start with the representation, we'll go to memory processing. And there's the part three, which, I think I'm too ambitious, put everything in, but I don't think maybe we will not have time to go into it. It's about kind of some fun discussions about unifying this mental travel in the past, which is memory retrieval, and this mental travel in the future, which is imagination, and what the memory is really constructive rather than a static trace, and the relationship of that to false memory and hallucination. Probably that will generate interesting discussions related to large language models. So maybe I don't have time to go to part three, but during one-on-one meetings with people will be fun discussion points. Okay, representation in the hippocampus. So to talk about representation in the hippocampus, we really have to start from this really seminal findings about place cells in hippocampus. How many of you guys heard of place cells? Okay. Some of you. Okay, that's good. So that means I have something to say. All right. So this discovery of place on the hippocampus, together with another kind of discovery called place cells, won the Nobel Prize in 2014. So basically, John O'Keefe recorded from the rat brain while he put animals in a box, and he observed this very interesting phenomenon where when the rat navigate the specific location in the brain, a particular cell would fire, and that cell would fire very specifically only when animal go to a specific corner of the space and become silent when animal go to any other corner. So he called those cells that are tuned to specific spatial location in space place cells. Okay, this is a video showing you in real time rat navigate in this complicated, in this long track. And here are the cells. So each dot is a spike when the cell fires, and each color represents a different cell. And as you can see, when animal is at here, this corner, this red cell is firing, right? And previously, when he was at this corner, the blue cell was firing. And so on and so forth, when animal goes to different parts of the maze, different cells would activate. So that is the concept of place cell. If each individual cell represent a specific location in the space, we take all the cells together. That's what John O'Keefe think, that you will have a cognitive map of the external world internally represented in the brain. And he hypothesized that hippocampus is this plays a role in this construction of cognitive map in the brain. Your question.
Here, how do you make sure that the cells which are activating is a function of space and not time?
That's a very good question. So you can test that, right? You can, when animal is at the other places, other corners, well, if If animal revisit the same location at different time, the
Okay, wait.
cell would bind in the same way. So it's invariant of the time, but variance of in terms of space. But that's a very good point. Later, you're thinking very much forward. Later, we'll talk about how hippocampus also represent time. Stay tuned.
So, if these are dependent on the specific locations of the coordinates, I am thinking of a scenario where there will be no turns, but you'll have a rat on a circle. So at that place, there will be a rat on a circle. At that place, there will be a rat on a circle. So instead of having turns, you'll have those as circles. And I'm wondering if it is on a circle at that point, will it always be blue? Or if it is
Yeah,
like
are you
corner dependent?
thinking about 3D?
No, 2D.
2D? And then it's just a
Right.
circle?
Yeah. At that location. Instead of having a turn, it's moving on a circle. And
And you
I'm
will just have place cells,
right.
place fields along this circle.
I will have like different circles. For example, there are different turns, and I will have circles on the turns. And I will just like measure its activity on the circle. And I will start a new experiment on another place. And it will also have a circle. So at every place, instead of having the turns, I will have circles, and it will be like separate trials.
I see what you're going, where you're going. You're saying that you have cert in a circular maze,
Right.
but you have a different circular maze. Do you know the same cell that fire at like a specific corner of maze one, does it fire course to fire at the other maze at the corresponding corner or like location? It's not the case. So this is you're thinking step ahead as well. So you know if you put animal in different environments, there's this phenomenon called remap. So basically the place cell would globally remap to fire at different locations when it's when the animal is in a different environment. So because hippocampal memory is very context dependent, when you're talking about a different context, you have a different kind of code for that environment. Later I will talk about there are some signals in the hippocampus that are preserved across environments. And we'll talk about that. But for the place cells, it's will undergo remap.
So do you have a baseline? Like,
Baseline activity.
how would these colors change if I measured at six random cells instead of place cells if I just put my electrodes somewhere?
Right. So about 30% of about 30% of the cells in the hippocampus are place cells. So meaning that they have very specific, we have like criteria for where when they meet the criteria of a place cell. But there are other cell types in hippocampus. Maybe some are tracking time, some are tracking the order of the events. Are you asking about
I just
like
wonder like how this picture would change if I measured different cells.
Right, they will have different properties,
Because
like
this
track.
picture looks, it's still the colors are kind of localized, but it still looks quite noisy, right?
Yes, so that's a very good point. That's this is the noisiness of biology, and also the noisiness of the single cell. And later we'll talk about how if you rather than build your cognitive map from single cells, but look at populations of cells, that would be a more robust way to look at things. So very good point. This is the biology looks like. This is the data of biology, very noisy.
Do these representations get more crisp and less noisy over time?
That's a very good question. Yes, it does. Over if you put the animal into a totally novel environment, never been there, your place fields are much more noisy comparing to if the animals get used to that environment. But it gets stabilized over time. Okay. Thanks for all the fascinating questions. So this cognitive map theory was kind of it's exciting, this discovery of place cells kind of provide a new basis for the cognitive theory. But the cognitive theory was not proposed by John O'Keefe. It was proposed by this guy called Edward Tolman back in 1948. So he did a series of very interesting experiments. Kind of at that time, the background is that at that time of point, all the neuroscientists are basically behaviorists. They believe in stimulate response associations. But Tolman doesn't think that way. Tolman think that like learning is more than about stimulate response association. To learn, you have mental constructions, you have a belief, and so you predict what you do based on those mental constructions. And for example, he designed this very clever experiments where at first the mouse would go through this channel and go to this spot G to get food. And animals are trained very, very well, very familiar with tasks. They always go this way to get re rewarded. And later, he then constructed this more complicated maze and add more arms into this maze and block the original pathway where the animal would get reward. And then now the animal is very, very hungry. Where should the animal go? And he find out that the animal would go to the path, like this path that is closest to where it was rewarded before the reconstruction. So that is his idea that, it's not animals not just remember this ritual of going into this specific path, but rather construct a map in the brain such that it's flexible when things in the environment are changing. So that was back in his time, he can only look at behaviors without having the tools to tap into the internal activity. So here comes to the part of my study. So instead of doing single cell recording, what I did was I recorded from large populations of cells in the hippocampus, and animals are running on this what we call figure eight maze. So similar to the video that I showed you, animal has to wait from here and then go turn left or right at this junction. And it's a memory task because the animal has to remember what is the previous turn, and it has to alternate in order to get rewarded. So it's a very simple task, but we can record when animal perform this memory task. And when after I got population activity, what I did was dimensionality reductions that I can look at what's the population representation look like. And after doing dimensionality reduction, that's what I see in B, right? This is the population activity in 2D. And you can see this really good correspondence between this manifold in the hippocampus and this physical environment in the outside world. So it's kind of I guess a another way to show this cognitive map. Yes.
So a couple questions. So first, how many neurons were you recording from? And then second, I don't think I fully understand like exactly what those colors correspond to in terms of like which neurons are firing when. So
Yes. So the colors color-coded by the spatial locations in the space. So, this is the actual maze, and I just superimpose animals' behavior trajectory on this maze. And you can see that at the beginning it's this blue, and at the reward part it's green and it's red. So it's this color-coded by the
Okay,
spatial
so the
location.
0 to 1 is progression through the maze.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, 0 to 1 is progression to the maze. Yeah.
And then the number of neurons, and then what were you doing dimensionality reduction on to make
Right.
that
Right.
measurable?
So basically, what you have is, so I recorded in this particular session, we recorded from 500 neurons simultaneously, which is a lot for electrophysiology. And then basically, what you will have after recording is a two-dimensional matrix of each row is a cell, activity of cell, and each column would be a time point. So it will be a matrix of each cell's activity over time. And then you do dimensionality reduction on that
I
matrix.
see.
Maybe
And
nonlinear. In this case, yes, it's a long, it's with UMAP. And then I plot the first two components.
the matrix is the matrix going to be binary? So it's either going to be if the
It's
neuron's firing or
the
not, or is it
firing
frequency at
rate.
that time?
It's the
I see.
firing rate is continuous, not binary.
Yeah, how do you decide those 500 cells to probe?
Yes, so those are the 500 cells are all the cells that we get from the hippocampus. So
Those are
we're interested in hippocampus, so we can check the coordinate where the hippocampus is and what target.
so is it like all the cells in the hippocampus?
No,
No, right.
the hippocampus has
Yeah.
millions of cells. And we are just take a very small samples from the whole hippocampal population. But in child, it's enough to help to reconstruct this cognitive map.
But how did you know that those 500s are the one?
Well, so it's distributed. So
Okay.
if you know roughly in this hippocampus where does there are pioneers who have done the work of mapping out
Okay, so
region.
okay,
You
okay.
know roughly where
Over,
in
over.
specific sub-region in the hippocampus you will find place cells, and we just
I
stick our
see.
electrode there.
Okay.
And
And
then
that's
you empirically test if you get place cells or not by
Yeah, okay.
finding these things. So
Okay.
before you don't know if you can
Yeah.
get it.
But
In a sub-region of the hippocampus where space is represented, it's really distributed. So you can stick your electrode. It's a relative large area that you can stick your electrode in, and it will always get place cell in that
Okay. Got it.
So his
region.
question was very great. His question was very great. So your result is that this manifold that you visualize kind of has these two loops. Or that's the result, right?
Sorry, what do you mean?
The result that you were presenting to us is that like the
The what?
manifold
The
that
what?
you
The result? Oh, the result.
get the result. Yeah.
The result.
Yeah.
Is that like this manifold that you obtained via dimensionality reduction
Right.
has two loops like the real maze?
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
Oh, sorry. Yes,
Yeah.
yes. So that's the point.
Okay.
Yes, the neural manifolds. It's amazing that you have internal representation in your brain that really mimic the struct topology of the external world, and kind of having basically demonstrating that you have cognitive map of the outside world in the brain.
So it's very interesting that you have two loops, and you chose like with your coloring scheme the both like left and right are both like symmetrically colored. But then in your manifold, it could also be that there's just like a single loop and like both left and right are encoded in the same way. I'm wondering whether if you were like do different coloring for left and right, would you s still see two loops? Is it like encoding left and right
It
differently or
is
not?
no, it is if you yeah, if I coded left and right, and then it will be very nice correspondence. One loop is the left, one the other loop is the right.
Completely distinct. That's interesting.
Completely distinct, yeah.
I have a question. So, I'm not from biology, but I do like neural network probing and intervention. So, whatever I'm seeing right here, I think this is probing, right, Professor? I'm not wrong. Can you also intervene? Like, you know what I mean?
Yes, definitely. I know exactly what you mean. So there is technology to do so, even though it's not perfect. But there's a technology called optogenetics. Long story short, you through virus injection, you inject some viral construct that have ion channels on it, so such that those ion channel will respond to light. So when you turn on a light of a specific frequency, that ion channel would open, that would force the cells to fire. Or if you have another light frequency, will force the cell, the ion channel to close, and the cell will be silent. And that way, you can kind of activate versus suppressing the activity of the cell in a very specific manner. But you know, it's biology is very challenging. You have to deliver the virus. You have to make sure it's like so many details. Unlike you guys can do patching, path patching and activation patching very easily. Yeah, but there are ways on and you're right, this is just recording without manipulation yet. Okay. Okay, so hippocampus, you know, since this Nobel Prize discovery, it's very interesting. Okay, we have this GPS in our brain that represents place, but you know, it's not just about space. We also represent time, and we also represent events. And it's turned out that the hippocampus also represents these other things. And I just want to talk one particular example of it, which is a study that I participating when I was undergrad student, where you know we're using a different technique. Instead of stick electrode into the brain, we implant a little glands so that we can imaging the firing of the cells of the brain. You know, this is the little camera that implants on top of the hippocampus. CA1 is a specific area of the hippocampus where there are a lot of light cells. I'm just saying, insert a small piece of glass on top of this so that we can imaging the activity of the cells where when the animal perform this task, where animal run around a maze in a structured way. So every 4 laps, the animal will get rewarded. So that's the structure that we imposed onto the task. And then we look at, okay, what is the activity look like in the brain? So what we find out is that the cells are not just very spatially specific. So like, for example, this cell, the heat map, the color represents the firing rate of the cell. The cell is very specifically only fired when the animal get to this corner of the space. But not just this. If you look at the activity across labs, so this is the activity during lab 1, this is lab 2, this is lab 3, and this is lab 4. This cell only selectively fire at lab 1. So we call this a lab 1 cell. Like orient you a little bit. So the x-axis is the location, like you linearized trajectory of this maze, and each row is a trial, and the heat maps color representing the firing rate of the neuron. So you know this cell fire at specific location, but also specific trial. Yes.
So sorry, for by lab, do you mean
Lab, lab, sorry,
Oh,
lab.
lap. Oh, okay. I heard lab and I was like, did you see different labs?
Sorry, yes. So every 4 lap, it will get rewarded, and that's how you get this the temporal structure. And then we can, as a reference, then we can look at, okay, does the cells are sensitive? Are the cells sensitive to this temporal structure?
Okay, and just to make sure I understand, one lap would be the animal starts goes all the way around the maze once, and then that completes the first lap, and then it
Exactly.
goes around again right away.
That's
That's the second one.
exactly. You got
Okay.
it. Yeah.
And also, like, these are different trials with different rats or the same rat?
The same animal,
The
the
same
same
rat.
animal in the same session. Yes.
Okay.
I just want to say that this work was done by the first author of this work is Chen, who is also a neuroscientist like me, but now started to work in large language models, and he's now DeepMind. He is my partner in science and life. Okay. So what is interesting about this event identity is that the if you look across days, so the cells that are firing at lab one will be also firing in day two. So this kind of identity, event identities observed across days. And what is even more interesting is that when you put the animal into a totally different maze in a maze here, so from a square box to a circle box, what you will observe in terms of the spatial map, this gets to your question a little bit. What you will observe in terms of spatial map is this global remapping. So if you look here, focus on here, you can see that this cell, this is the same cell, it fires at this corner when it's the square maze. But when you change this local configuration, you know, to a circle environment, it's remap to fire at a different location. So so the space signal remap, but very interesting, this time, this event identity preserved. So if you also let the animal to run, every four laps get a reward in this different environment, this sequence, like the order structure, preserved across different environment. So it's interesting how some of the signals are invariant, some are variant. Okay. Yeah, okay, so I've already talked about this. You know, we record, this is now back to my recent work. Put the animal into this figure eight maze, you get a 2D matrix of spiking data in two-dimensionality reduction. And what I'm looking at now is that you've seen this is the spatial map from the population point of view. But there's also this very interesting thing that this event sequence, the order of the events, are also represented in the population level in the hippocampus. So, you know, in the bottom panels, as I, you know, colored this manifold in a different way, instead of color with respect to the spatial location, I color with respect to the progress in the session, so the trial number. And you can see this very nice organization from early to late trials, very orderly represented in the manifold as well. So hippocampus also keep track of the time, not just the space.
Small question. Does this timer reset sometimes?
Yes, that's a very good question. So, you know, looking at the previous study, the single cell study about the trials, like every four trials, you get a reward, right? That's kind of a reset. So every four times, when it resets. And so it's the short answer is there are those different signals. There are ones that are reset, maybe looking at similarities across time. You know, when it's lab one again, it's finding this similarity and reset. And there are times where it's just continuously drifting away with the time. And that's the picture that we're seeing here. So there are cells that are tracking different aspect. Cells that can reset and cells that are continuously drifting away, basically.
So there are some cells that will continue to drift throughout
Throughout.
the life of the animal.
Right.
I'm sorry, what is time here? Is it like 70 trials
Yes,
or
70 trials.
okay.
Is there if you did UMAP in like three dimensions instead, would it like stratify the number of trials more clearly there?
If you 2D is already enough to represent this, but if you see 3D, you can see the structure better, but nothing fundamentally changed if you go to 3D.
Does it look continuous in 3D?
What do you mean continuous?
Like, so over here,
You see that yeah.
the spiral spike.
Right. You can. It's continuous. You can. It's continuous. Yeah. I hope I have. Yeah. I had an animation that it's rotating 3D. It's not here. I will send to you maybe offline. You will see what it's like in 3D.
Another question. Maybe I missed something, but if you're looking at different populations, right? It's like one some time cells and some space cells. So, what is it the same thing?
Okay, good question. It's not like time cells will always be time cells and place cells will be always be place cells. So in a different environment, it could in a different environment, this time cell here can be a place cell there. And also, the picture get more complicated when people now start to, reformalize what is hippocampus is doing. It's not just space and time, it can be any continuous task relevant variable. So for example, this now the space is not the physical space, it's a sound space, for example, frequency of the tone. So the animal would be trying to listen to different frequency of the tone and press the lever at certain frequency. Then here the variable that the animal has to track is the sound space. And if you look at it, the brain and the hippocampus, there are sound frequency cells. So basically tracking this continuous progression in this other space, so basically hippocampus is just it's also a memory machine, right? It's recording your experience. So whatever cognitive variable that you're engaging with, the hippocampus will keep track of it. And it's very flexible. So the sound frequency cell, when it's tracking the space, is the place cell.
I have a very stupid question or remark. So if we think of it like this is the set of mouse or rat, but if we put VR on those rats and mouse, how would it change?
Very good question, and people have done that. People have had fixed the animal with some construct, and then put them onto a ball where they're just running on this rotating ball, and there's the VR screen in front of the animal in the record, and you see place cells.
The same thing? Yeah.
You see the same thing.
Just one quick
So it
question.
doesn't use GPS then.
It's the GPS in this virtual world.
So I think it's similar to John's question. So in this particular task, did you see like a distinction between the place cells and the time cells, or were the same set of cells acted both as a place cells and a time cell? Timer,
Okay,
yeah.
yeah, good question. Let me just I okay. Short question is sometimes there are cells that are just purely place cells, so it will always fire at a specific location, regardless of which trial it is, meaning it will fire at exactly same, like approximately the same frequency, firing rate. But there are cells, they're place cells, so they fire at a specific location. But the firing rate will be different according to the time.
I see.
So it's conjunctive. right? It's both representing the space and time. So that's actually most of the case. Most of the cells that I see are conjunctive place and time cells.
So when you're analyzing these, all the cells seem like independent rows of this matrix. Are there physical relationships between the cells that
I should think about? Yeah, there is no relationships. There is no mapping between the physical space, like the physical proximity and the proximity of the cell in the brain. So there are brain areas like work that way. For example, there's retinal mapping, you know, the physical world, the pixels that are close to together in the physical world are represented by cells in your retina that are close to each other. And similar, your somatosensory system, two fingers are represented by cells that are, there's a homunculus in the brain, but space doesn't work that way. It's like salt and pepper, it's distributed.
So your UMAP shape is the same for the space and the time experiment, right? Does that mean that all the individual neurons that you look at have the same frequencies? In the previous slide. How was...
Not this. This.
Oh yeah, you had like space and time and it was like two different colorings. Yes. Oh, that was the next slide. Absolutely. And it's like neural manifold for space and time has the same shape.
It's the same.
It's the same manifold. I just color them the different way.
Which means that they have the same frequency.
No, she's just using the same UMAP.
It's the same data, same transformation, same manifolds. It's the same data.
Oh, the same experiments, but the same recording. Okay. Yeah.
Way. Okay. Yes. The coloring is post hoc.
Oh, nice. Okay.
One question. I'm sorry to ask a lot. So when you measure this activation or like sorry firing, do they have the same threshold or the threshold is different for different neurons?
Okay. So the threshold for firing is the same for every neuron. There's membrane potential you can measure and crossing a certain threshold. There will be an action potential. That threshold is the same for every neuron. But across that threshold, the cell would fire. But fire at what frequency, that will be different.
Okay. I have one question. I actually got lost. Why are you saying that these neurons are mapping time or representing time, because in the second figure it is kind of like individual columns of your matrix that the UMAP was calculated on projected on the UMAP, right?
The whole matrix gets dimensionality reduction.
Yes. But when you map it with time dimension on the second row, if you just go back one slide on the matrix, So this is the matrix the UMAP was calculated on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And on the second row of images in next slide, they are kind of like If I'm understanding properly, individual columns of the matrix projected on the UMAP, and that's how you color it, right? What do you do here?
So each dot represents a point in time. Oh, that's what you mean. So each You're saying that each dot corresponding in this two-dimensional space corresponding to one time, which is one column. in this high dimensional space.
Okay,
Can you shape
time and
more?
trial are not the same thing here, right? Is that the same thing? Time and trial?
Well, time and trial is not the exact same, but instead of color with time, I color, you know, it's correlated, right, in this particular case.
Okay.
So, sorry, wait. Am I understanding? So there's a number of dots equal to the number of columns?
Yes.
Okay, so your dimensionality reduction was along the rows. You went from n rows, where n is the number of neurons,
exactly,
to two.
Yeah. Dimensionality reduction is done on number of neurons, basically. So, yeah, the number of dimension corresponding to number of neurons.
You know, kind of side question, but do you know Pascal Wallace? Because I know he's at NYU, and he's like the world expert in like dealing with spike trains. Like he's like really good at like, he has a whole bunch of statistics on like how to do spike train stuff really well.
Interesting. I seriously don't know.
I think he's like in the Center for Neural Data Science there.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. All right. If you you know, do this kind of analysis in different spatial kind of configurations, here is a linear maze. So you saw this earlier when I showed the videos, animals go back and forth on the linear track. You do this, you will see kind of similar phenomenon. If you move on to a more complicated maze, here's a radio arm maze where there are 8 arms on the maze. And if you look at the manifold, it looks like this. It's kind of mimicking this spatial configuration as well. And if you look at the neural manifold in, colored in trials, there's this nice representation of the trial event as well. So just to say that this phenomenon is observed in different tasks and different rodent species. In the linear maze, we recorded from rats, the radio arm maze, recorded from mouse. Okay, so that was the part about the representation in the brain. Now we move on to memory processing. Oh, wow, time.
I'm fine. It's all right. We can go over a little bit.
Okay. When should I stop? Just to get a sense of how fast I should move.
So we have this room for quite a while, and so you could shoot for as late as noon.
12.
Yeah, and maybe we could take a little break, and then we have a second talk that's scheduled at noon.
Sounds good.
We could, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I will try to go quickly, and we can always talk after. So here's the part about memory. And you know, brain is very different from large language models in at least this aspect, that brain is a continual learning machine. Like there's no pre-training, post-training. Brain is continuously learning and all updating its weight with new experience. And there's this classical problem of catastrophe forgetting in neural networks, where when you learn new information, this new information would catastrophically interfere with the old information. So it's a very hard problem to solve in neural networks. But the brain solved this problem, right? We continuously learn new information, not at the expense of destroying what we have learned before. So what is the brain's solution for this catastrophic forgetting problem? Well, the theory goes back from 1989. So my mentor, Yuri Bazaki, in the 90s, proposed this two-stage model of memory formation. So he hypothesized that in order to solve this catastrophic forgetting problem, you have to form your memory in two stages. The first stage is this memory encoding stage, which hippocampus play a crucial role, because hippocampus has those very, very rapid synaptic changes. So it's very plastic. It can rapidly learn new things and encode it on the fly when you experience new information. very fast change or update weights on the flight while you're learning information, right? You know, this is good in terms of it can rapidly change, but this rapid change can bring problems. You know, when you learn new information, are you sure this, if this new information is contradictory or in conflict with your world model, are you sure you always wanted to rapidly update your world model just based on this single experience, right? The world is very noisy. So the solution of the brain is to have this two separate system, the hippocampus, fast, record everything. But later, when you wanted to simulate and integrate this new learning into the existing knowledge framework, there is the second stage called consolidation phase, where new experience during offline period, when you're not having this online demand for encoding new information, these learning episodic experience are gradually transferred to neocortical networks for long-term storage, where the memory will transform from episodic memory to more semantic-like memory. And because there is no demand of fast encoding, there is time to resolve conflict and slowly incorporate new information without damaging the old memory. So that was Yuri's theory, right? This is totally theory with no evidence at that point. And like, he not only like proposed this theory, but he hypothesized a neural mechanism for how this could happen. So what his bread and butter in the lab is he recorded from hippocampus, and he sees this very interesting activity. You know, you stick a wire into the brain, you can see a population activity in the brain, and that's what we call local field potential. It's basically population activity. And if you and what Yuri observed is there are those very strange events that, you know, every now and then the brain would fire in very, very high frequency, about 100 to 200 hertz, really fast bursting of activity. And what underlying those very bursty activity, those bursty activity are called Shapley ripples. And underlying those events are essentially population bursts. So cells fire together in a very synchronized way. And, you know, those Shapley ripples, it occurs when animal is not actively paying attention in encoding new information, not during learning or navigating, but during what he called offline period, when animals are quiet, awake, or during sleep, you will observe those events. And Yuri hypothesized that these Shapley ripples can be a neurophysiological mechanism that support memory transfer. So during those events, cells firing in a rapid, synchronously in a high frequency. So experience will be repetitively reactivated during those events and potentially transferred to the cortex. Yeah.
So many of the things are jargons to me, but what I wanted to know is, do we actually forget anything?
Yes. Okay. And that's, you're thinking one step ahead, and that's what I want to talk about next. Okay. But just to, you know, give you a sense of this Shapley ripple. So I said that it happens during quiet awake. So whenever the animal stops, so this is plotting, you know, because you have this spatial map of the brain, then if you have the recording of the hippocampus cells, then you can decode where the animal is. And this is showing the decoded location from hippocampal activity. To make the story simple, when animals are quite awake, not really running and actively sampling new information, if you decode activity in the brain, you will see that the cells are decoded to represent not the current location of the animal, but some other part of the brain, some other part of the maze. So this during those quiet awake and sharp wave ripples, people have we what we find is that when animals actively sampling the environment, you will see a specific sequence of cell that is firing, right? The place cells firing in sequence. But when animal go to sleep or when it's quite awake, what we observe is that specific sequence of cell would reactive in the exact same order as when the animal is experienced the world. So this is the word re memory replay, right? As if that this memory has been reactivated again. Urey hypothesized at the time that ripples would replay the memory, but at that time there is no evidence because we couldn't record. But in the 90s, nineties, that's the first time people could record from enough cells in the brain and basically demonstrate that indeed, during those shock wave ripple events, cells that you will see those reactivation of the activity of the neurons, such that they reactive in a way that the sequence really mimic the sequence when the animal is experience the external world. So that's memory replay during shock wave ripples. So you asked, does the brain forget? And yes, we definitely don't remember everything in our life, what we experience. So memories are selectively consolidated during shockwave ripples during sleep, but how some of the memories are forgotten. So how does the brain select what to remember and what to forget? That is indeed a important question, and actually that was what my recent work was about. I will just, without going to the details, just very, very high level, tell you about this kind of mechanism that we find about memory selection. We call that when animal is learning on this maze, we can have a manifold that's represents the space, and this manifold also give us information of the event, the specific event. So that is very good because if we have this handle on the event, then we can look at how those different events are selectively reactivated or consolidated during sleep. But we can, we can differentiate those different events. Then we can look at them during offline period, how they are consolidated. So the way we did it is, this is an example event, cells are firing. We can decode not only which part of the maze this event is replaying about, but we can also decode which individual event this replay event is replaying. And we can do that when animal is quiet awake on the maze during sharp wave ripples. And we can do that when animal go to sleep afterwards during non-REM sleep. And then if we look at the relationship between what is replayed during a wake ripple and what is replayed during sleep ripple, it's this very interesting correlation that, you know, some of the events are consolidated much more frequently during sleep than others. And the sleep replay frequency distribution is plotted in purple, and the red is the maze replay. So what you're seeing here is that, you know, some of the events, for example, those early trials, the proportion of those events get replayed is very low. So they're not very they're not being reactivated during sleep, but the interesting part is that those events not get activated during sleep are also the events that are not get activated during awake replay. And so our hypothesis is that, you know, there's this very high correlation between what is replayed when animal is on the maze and what is replayed when animal go to sleep later. So our hypothesis is this. Awake ripples act as a memory tag such that the events that wanted to be remembered and stored are tagged by those ripples such that when animal go to sleep later, only the events that has this memory tag would be, you know, rehearsed and repetitively reactivated and consolidated or potentially transferred into the neocortex. And those events that doesn't have this memory tag are being forgotten. They're not reactivated, rehearsed, and they're forgotten.
So it's on the same day, right? So
it's on the same day, yes.
So if you give it like seven different environments,
uh-huh.
How would it react? Like how would this change over time?
So if you, what do you mean? How would it change?
So you have one setting
mm-hmm.
on Friday,
yeah.
Another setting on Saturday.
Uh-huh. So
you give like new task every single day, like
uh-huh.
new environment.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to understand like how the distribution of this memory tags change. Like after, if you record it after 7 days,
uh-huh.
So how the long-term memory over 7 days sum up versus what happened on Friday night? Do you understand my question?
I understand your setup where you wanted to record across days when there are diversity of experience. So here, the events are in the same day, but you're curious about events that are across different days. And what about...
So what I wanted to understand is like, if it is like very short term, like it only cares about what happened the last day.
Uh-huh. Comparing to it's a long-term memory.
Yeah. Over 7 days. Like,
uh-huh.
So when I'm like
right.
dreaming about it.
Right.
So
Yes. Okay. You're thinking about whether the recent experience get replayed
right.
more
yeah.
or the remote experience
yeah.
get replayed more. I mean, I don't have an answer for this, and I don't think there is a short answer for this. This is really depending on other factors. For example, how salient this experience is, you know, even if it's a remote experience, if it's very novel to the animal. So we know this, like novelty is very important. So novel experience will get disproportionately replayed much more than a like normal experience. So recency is a factor, like everything constant, recent experience would get reactivated more than remote experience, but novelty would override this. So many factors interplay. But I guess the message here is whatever the experience that get really get activated a lot during sleep, during this, you know, offline periods, those experience you can predict which experience by looking at the awake ripple activity. Yes.
I think there's so many interesting connections to LLMs that, like, I don't know, is there any research on like memory consolidation over like a sequence of tokens? Because like memory tags, I wonder if there's a way, maybe if there are memory tags, I have no idea if the research is out there, then like maybe you could also detect memory tags by like introducing like novel tokens of some kind, or like maybe there's a signal there. I don't know. This is really cool. So thank you so much.
Yeah, but the brain is also very different from LLM. Like, what is even memory tag for LLM, right? Also, LLM doesn't have this offline period, at least now. So there's all in this forward pass when we interact with it. So that's corresponding to this encoding phase. It wouldn't engage into this offline period. But actually, what I wanted to say is that maybe that's something that we need to introduce to large language models, to have this offline period where it goes through the things it has learned, find commonalities, do comparisons across experience, and abstract out commonality, abstract rules, and build world models. But those are not present now.
Would the offline period be considered like something where, you're giving like in context like some things? So it's like looking at the model is looking at things in context, and then at a certain point it like looks back into its internal knowledge and gives output based on that.
You're saying that even during in context learning, in order to solve this in context learning task, it's retrieving knowledge from the weights.
So some sort of memory.
Right. So there can be this maybe implicit memory retrieval process that's going on during learning.
But I guess the difference there is then you don't have the chance to reorganize what happened in the past. You only simply retrieve what's in the past. Because if you do in context, you don't do in with at the same time. At least the current, you either do in context or in with versus us, it's always a mix. Would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jojo made a good point that this is closer to this retrieval part rather than this the system consolidation where you can really look at experiences across context windows, not just in context, but looking at experience across context, find regularities and organizes. So I still don't think we have a correspondence in large language models now. And I'm very interested in like novel ways to I think a large language model need a hippocampus for the continued learning problem.
When I look at this, it reminds me much more of like reinforcement learning.
Right. Offline.
Okay.
Yes. This is the thing that I don't have time to talk about, but there's this very rich literature and kind of this virtuous circle of exchange of idea between this replay literature and the neuroscience, as well as this offline replay literature in RL. So Dennis Hassabis, before he find it DeepMind, he was a cognitive neuroscientist, and specifically he was interested in memory, and he did a lot of fMRI studies looking into how human memory works. So he's very interested in this concept of mental traveling in the past, mental traveling in the future, and in the early days they have papers about drawing this inside of replay and use that for improving RL. So for example, the deep Q learning, the deep Q network is actually they have this replay buffer
That you know, deep neural network really improved that target games to like human level. And one of very important components of is this replay buffer, and it's actually inspired by how memory replay work in the brain. If you read their blog post, at least that's what they say their inspiration comes from.
The engineer who designs the learning algorithm in this way and trains the model, right? And then it's frozen and can play the video games. So neuroscience that you show is very interesting because the learning just happens at the same, the agent just learns, right?
Right.
Kind of, that's a big difference.
Yeah, very big difference. It's continuously updating its weight. Yeah, after in-context learning, the insight you get from in-context learning in large language model will be gone, right? Whatever the chain of thought, get the conclusion you get from this very computational heavy chain of thought reasoning, if there's important lesson there, in another session, it's gone. And so a temporary would not get updated, but the brain...
The human engineers will lock all of it and they will throw it into the next training run.
Yes, that's, I, yes. I mean, have you guys noticed that you like, all has memory for across session, like it's remember your personal preference and traits. But I guess
it doesn't it do that discreetly? Like it'll like sometimes decide that like something that you tell
yeah,
it is worth going
in. Yeah. So I think people started to, you know, trying to build in this kind of long-term memory aspect or semantic memory like aspect, but
I think it's pretty premature though.
Very premature.
Very different.
Very preliminary. Yeah. And I feel like there's a lot to do to improve.
I feel like the closest we have is like fine-tuning a bunch of LoRAs and doing it like very frequently, but that's not still not really the same.
Yeah, and I'm curious if you guys know, like, if you do this fine-tuning in a continuous learning setup, like you continuously fine-tune on like different tasks, does this catastrophic forgetting for a problem, like I know it's a big problem for neural networks, but for this very large models in the current regime, has anyone done studies on this, like whether this catastrophic forgetting is still a big problem?
Eventually, that is kind of like bound to happen. Right? I mean, in Mehmet, we went up to 10,000 edits, but eventually the model performance does degrade by a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are decay of human memory as well over time, but I guess maybe there's suboptimal ways when this can happen if some... you know, humans can learn some abstract rules from experience, and the specificities can be gone, but the abstract rules can remain. Things like that, like the system consolidation aspect of it, if it can be incorporated, would be very helpful. Yeah. All right. I think that's all I have for now.
We've gotten to noon.
Yeah.
So let me stop the recording here.